Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Pat Conroy writes in the prologue to his new memoir, The Death of Santini, "I hated my father long before I knew there was a word for hate." Conroy's novel, The Great Santini, published in 1976, was drawn from his childhood experiences dealing with his abusive Marine Corps fighter pilot father, Donald Patrick Conroy. He ruled his battered family with an iron fist. Donald Conroy died in 1998, and Pat Conroy said he wanted to go back one more time to examine how his father's volatile and domineering personality shaped, distorted, even damaged his family. It's frightening to read about his father's rages and the physical and psychological pain that he inflicted on his wife and his children. Conroy also writes about how he became a version of his dad and how later in life he was able to develop a more loving relationship with his father. Pat Conroy is here with us in our Philadelphia studios. It's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
How are you, Marty? It's great to be here.
I'm very well. And how are you?
Good.
Is this book a kind of a last rite for you and your relationship with your father?
I certainly hope so. You know, I've been writing about this family for 40 years. I think it's the only subject I've ever written about. It is time for me to move on to something else. And since I live in the age of vampires and zombies and interstellar space, and there are many subjects I have not yet dealt with, but I think I was born into an alien family, and that's what I have been writing about. So there's some correlation here, too.
So the idea of perhaps using zombies as a kind of fill-in for the for your father or the rest of your family. But do you really feel like with this book that you're not done with your life, because you're never done with your life, but done with sort of writing about your family and all
Yeah, I certainly hope so. You know, there's certain stories. That, in fact, my family has been – my Chicago Irish family wants me to write a story about the Chicago Irish, but I know nothing about them. There are different parts of my Southern family that think I denigrated the Southern branch. They would like me to do it. But for me, it was always the personal psychodrama that took place within my own family, my mother and father, the seven kids. Right. They produced six miscarriages, and I thought, you know, the miscarriages were the luckiest people on earth. I mean, and my sister always thought they heard what was going on and just said, no way, man, I'm not going into that. But it was a difficult childhood. To me now, it looks like a criminal childhood. Mm.
Well, and as a reader, it feels almost like living under, as you write about it, a kind of a terrorist regime.
You know, there are no surprises in life for me when I meet the latest Ayatollah, when I meet a czar, when I meet a dictator, when I meet, you know, someone who is genocidal, somebody who is, you know, absolutely hateful in running a country. It just reminds me of the way Dad ran a family.
Well, as I said, and you write in your book that you said, I hated my father long before I knew there was a word for hate. You were a little boy.
I
you didn't have
that
language, but you had hate.
I hated him when I was in diapers, and I hated him when I was being fed while Mom was, you know, spooning in whatever baby food she was. In my first memory, they had a thing by PEN America, had a thing a couple of years ago about your first memory. And I didn't write mine because I wasn't ready then to tell. But my first memory was of my father beating my mother to the floor with a backhand and her trying to stab him with a butcher knife. And this to me was, hey, Pat, welcome to the world. And this became such, you know, an obvious token of what my life was going to be like, what the life of my brothers and sisters was going to be like. And my mother suffered through it for 33 years.
In fact, you write that, and I do want to have you read a eulogy that you wrote when your father died, but you do write that your siblings used denial and repression, whereas you, the oldest son, you remembered everything. Was that your fate in life somehow?
You know, I think I was fated to remember. I remember writing the book about the Citadel, the Lords of Discipline. Mm-hmm. And I go back to the plebe system to talk to my classmates. I seem to be the only one that could remember what happened. they could remember hardly anything. And it happened when I wrote about the Citadel basketball team, and it certainly happened with this book. When I go back to ask my brothers and sisters, look, okay, here's what I remember. Tell me what you remember. Almost invariably, nothing. Now, my brother Mike works in the he's now retired, in the South Carolina Mental Hospital for 35 years. And he was an administrator there. And what Mike would tell me all the time, he'd say, Pat, everybody who is a permanent resident of Bull Street, which is what we call it in South Carolina, everybody in Bull Street lacks all powers of denial. They have no powers of denial, therefore they're crazy. I have developed great powers of denial, and I love my powers of denial. I wouldn't give them up for anything. I think denial is a form of health.
And he thought, this is your brother talking.
Yes, my brother, who worked with the mentally ill for his whole life. And he said, mental illness to me is defined by you. You who remember everything, even when it's so painful, it leads you towards suicide and depression and breakdown all the time. And I seem healthier than you do to me.
Do you think he's right?
I think he's on to something. I tell Mike he's right.
But do you feel like you have suffered? I mean, it sounds like your whole family has suffered, but I have, and I feel like we know your family because we read The Great Santini. I think many people saw the movie. But do you feel you suffered because you can remember?
You know,
and
I think,
perhaps relive and write and rewrite?
You know, I think I have. You know, I think it's something, but it is thrust upon the writer. It's thrust upon the poet. It's not particularly a gift. It's a given. And it's something that, you know, I've known my whole life that eventually I was going to have to turn to this. And if I was going to tell a story, the one I had to tell was forbidden to tell. I knew this was true with the Irish Catholics. I knew it was true with the Southern Mountain people of my mother. And I knew it was going to be a betrayal, a Judas-like act. Once, you know, I brought this out in the open, and frankly, I was stunned. Even though I knew this, I was stunned by the ferocity of the reaction of my family on both sides when The Great Santini came out, and I am waiting for this one.
I'm waiting for this one as well. But, do you trust your memory? And I ask you that if you live with people who deny things that you believe happened, and they all deny them, and you're the storyteller, and memory can be a fuzzy thing, and we can distort our own memories, thinking that they're very real.
I trust my memory pretty well. And the one thing I have always done, because I'm mouthy and I have a big mouth, I've always retold the stories that happened to us. And all the kids know these stories because we have discussed them so many times. My brother Tim brought up the subject. Was dad ever nice to us?
Yes.
Did he ever do one nice thing to us in his whole life? And we sat there, all seven of us, thinking, did he buy us an ice cream cone? No. Did he take us out for a hot dog? No. Did he take us to a ball game? No. We could come up with nothing that he ever did, just naturally being nice, naturally being a father. And we can come up, now that we're older, we come up with excuses for dad. But at that time, we could come up with absolutely nothing except he seemed to like to be mean. He seemed to like to be a dictatorial, authoritarian, and he seemed to like to hurt people.
It must be such a burden to feel that you hated your father. I mean, a burden for the child to carry that kind of hate. And I have to say, without giving too much of the book away, I mean, I don't know if reconciliation is too strong a word, but you certainly, after The Great Santini was published, your father became your defender because the family was very angry at you for exposing all these secrets and I guess telling tales. And your dad was there to defend you to some degree.
Yeah, you know, the biggest surprise of my life was when The Great Santini was published. Dad evidently threw the book across the room, stomped it. disappeared for days. His whole family would call me, say he's killed himself. Nice going, Pat. You killed your father. And, of course, I felt horrible. But Dad hears his family is jumping on me, so he comes back and writes him a letter saying that his son wrote this book. He'd read it. He said he loved the description of the mother, the children, the Marine Corps, but his son did not have enough talent. His son did not have enough greatness. His son did not have enough vision to write about the great Santini himself. Mm. And that was the only failure in the book. So he then started signing books with me for the rest of his life, wherever I went.
Well, in fact, he called himself the great Santini. Yeah? Well, I mean, he embraced that.
He was called that by the Marines when he grew up in the Marine Corps. And, you know, he loved that image of himself. He had a license plate, the great Santini, on his car in Atlanta. That he'd drive. People would beep at him, and Dad would beep back. And Dad loved playing that celebrity role. Dad would go on radio stations. Okay, who's that guy that Dad loved? Neil Bortz in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And I don't think Neil ever asked me to wash his car. But he had Dad on all the time to talk about child rearing. And I would, you know, get picked Dad up, and I'd say, Dad, you sounded great. The Nazi Dr. Spock. But America falls in love with Nazis, Dad. Mm. They're going to love your character. They're just going to absolutely love it. And Dad rode that wave for the rest of his life.
And like the idea of being a Nazi Dr. Spock?
Oh, he loved the idea of being a celebrity. You know, Dad, when we would have he'd be in a signing line of mine. His favorite moment is he would look up, and he'd look over at me and he'd say, my line's longer, son.
Wow. Were you surprised that he, after that book and all the reaction to the book, we're almost up in a break here, but that he sort of embraced this portrait that you painted of him?
He embraced it in such a way you would not have. Dad died thinking he was responsible for Robert Duvall's career. Before he played me, son, he had no roles with any meat on it. Any masculinity on it. And I said, Dad, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, yeah, he did okay. He said, but he couldn't carry a movie until he played the great Santini. I made that man. And I said, Dad, it's your modesty that Hollywood looks for most of all. But, you know, he thought it was stupid killing Santini at the end. And I said, why? And he said, it messed up the sequel.
Goodness. Well, I have to recover from that. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking with Pat Conroy, as we all know, the author of The Great Santini, made into a movie starring Robert Duvall. And our guest, Pat Conroy, has a new book. It's a memoir called The Death of Santini. And after this very short break, I'm going to have him read from a eulogy that he wrote for his father when he died about 15 years ago. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Rehoboth Beach Independent Film Festival, November 6th through the 10th, showcasing 100 American and international features, documentaries, short films, and seminars, all at the beach in Delaware. Details at rehobothfilm.com.
Just this weekend, more than 30 people were killed when a wedding convoy was ambushed in northern Nigeria. The violence is blamed on Boko Haram, an extremist group that claims to fight against westernization. NPR's West Africa correspondent Ofebio Quist-Arkton recently visited the town Boko Haram calls home. She tells us about it next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the late Fela Kuti pioneered Afrobeat music as protest music. So where is that genre today?
Dirty, not dirty money, oh. Dirty money, not the flow.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. on newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Pat Conroy, author of 11 books, including The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, many others, and he's got a new book. It's a memoir called The Death of Santini, A Story of a Father and His Son, and our guest lives in South Carolina, rather near where he was born. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Well, I really liked your eulogy for your father, and I picked out a little section there, and I was wondering if you could read that for us.
Be happy to. We have gathered here today to celebrate the amazing and storied life of Colonel Donald Conroy, who modestly called himself by his nom de guerre, the Great Santini. There should be no sorrow at this funeral, because the Great Santini lived life at full throttle, moved always in the fast lanes, gunned every engine, teetered on every edge, seized every moment and shook it like a terrier shaking a rat. He did not know what moderation was or where you go to look for it. Donald Conroy is the only person I've ever known whose self-esteem was absolutely unassailable. There was not one thing about himself that my father did not like, nor was there one thing about himself he would change. He simply adored the man he was and walked with perfect confidence through every encounter in his life. Dad wished everyone could be just like him. His stubbornness was an art form. Once I introduced my father before he gave a speech to an Atlanta audience. I said at the end of the introduction, "My father decided to go in the Marine Corps on the day he discovered his IQ was the temperature of this room." My father rose to the podium, stared down the audience, and without skipping a beat said, "My God, it's hot in here. It must be at least 180 degrees.
That's quite a passage, and your eulogy just touched on so many different things, including, of course, this fierce father that you had, who, and you're not exaggerating, who thought he was always right.
You know, Dad never admitted that he hit any of us or my mother, and I consider that a weak spot of his manhood. I consider that a blot on his character. And, you know, I think he came close to it a couple of times. He could not bring himself to cross that line ever. But, you know, he was vicious to my mom's life breaks my heart. And, you know, she suffered a great deal. And I used to pray that she would divorce him. All the kids did. You know, but now I see a girl who didn't go to college, seven kids, what was she going to do? She was completely trapped in that. And mom was going nowhere, dad was going nowhere, and our life was going downhill at a rapid clip. Mm. And that was the life I was born into and the one I lived.
But as you said, your siblings live in some degree of denial, but your father denying something that he absolutely did.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows he did it, even if they didn't want to talk about it. I mean, does that make him just a colossal liar?
Well, here's what Dad would do, too. He had a very good sense of humor. And he would try. We didn't know this when we were kids, by the way. We didn't laugh once when we were growing up. But he developed this very funny persona. And he once told me we were riding back from something, a radio show like this. And we were both interviewed, and Dad said, "You know, son, I should have beat you more. You'd be a lot better writer." And I said, "Dad, if you'd beat me much more, I'd be Shakespeare." Mm. And he said, you know, he would always come close to hinting, but there was never an actual moment when he said, "Okay, this is it. This is what happened. You know, I'm sorry." He could not do that.
But do you think your father turned you into a writer, and your father's abusive behavior made you a writer?
Yeah, it made me one. And I think it turned my sister into a poet in New York. And I think coupled with my mother's extraordinary love of reading, her love of books, her love of story, to mix in this incredibly violent family, and especially the family that holds secrets. You know, that is always the volatile family. And I think it's always the normal one. It's always the one you're not supposed to tell. And every family knows what they're not supposed to tell.
Right.
And you can be living a life right now, and there's stories you know should not come up anytime, anywhere, and they almost never do.
You have said that you wrote The Great Santini because you wanted to understand why your father beat his family.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you – do you know why? Why he was as abusive and as violent and as tyrannical, domineering as he was?
You know, I have a theory, Murray. I don't know if it's true or not. I think men treated women like that. I think there was a lot of that going on.
The 50s and the 60s?
Yep. Excuse me. You know, I think that was going on in a lot of different houses. I think it was going on during the 20s and 30s, the 1890s, 1870s. I think this has been a part of marriage and the relationship between men and women. What I've been delighted by, especially as a father of five daughters, is that I've gotten to watch the great rise of women in this country. I've gotten to watch great revolutions, the blacks in the South, the civil rights movement. What's happening in gays now is absolutely stunning and amazing and wonderful to me. But guys like Dad in that kind of attitude, you know, had to be defeated first.
You describe a scene, it was with your first wife, Barbara.
Right.
A scene where your father is just, he's lost his temper and he's just going after everybody. And she's sleeping up on the second floor. And she comes down and tries to sort of figure out what is going on down here. And you, your siblings, your mother, everyone just bursts out laughing. And she says, you all are just crazy.
Well, you know, poor Barbara. I had heard it. And it was the old story that Dad was going to Vietnam. He and Mom went out to the movie with the kids, and it's normal.
Yeah.
Before he goes to Vietnam. When they came back to the house that Barbara and I now owned, we owned a house before Mom and Dad did, is I heard the old sound. Mom crying, the slaps, my brothers and sisters crying. So I was sneaking downstairs, and I saw him slap Mom. I went after him. And I'd never done this in my life. I would promise myself I would not be like Dad. I knocked him to the door. I kicked him across the yard. I got him in his car, told him to get out of there and never come back. And when I came back in the house trying to calm Mom and the kids, Barbara wakes up. What's going on in my house? I said, oh, nothing, dear. Nothing at all. And she said, there's something horrible going on in my house. I demand that you tell me. And I said, oh, nothing. One of the kids fell. And it was the old lie. I've been drawn back in the old lie. Until finally my mother and brothers and sisters just cracked up laughing because the scene was so ridiculous.
Yeah. And she says, you all are crazy.
You're all nuts. And she comes down and we tell her the story. Barbara Conroy learned the story. She was the first person on earth that I told.
Did it feel good to tell her? Yeah. Let me reintroduce you. And again, that's Pat Conroy, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about his new book, a memoir called The Death of Santini, subtitled The Story of a Father and His Son. He's the author of The Great Santini, written, what, about 25 years ago?
Came out in 76.
In 76, so I can't do the math quite, but almost 30 years ago. And, of course, fictionalization of his father, The Great Santini, and made into a movie as well. And we are taking calls. Any questions or comments? I'm sure you have read or perhaps even seen the movie of The Great Santini and have questions about this relationship. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I also got the feeling in reading this book that there were moments in your life where you felt you were rather like your dad.
Ugh.
And part of it with a temper, you talk about your brother, Tom, who committed suicide, but having to deal with him and feeling the kind of rage and frustration and anger at him that for whatever reason, it seems your father felt towards his family.
You know, the brothers in the family, we have a game we play. It is a horrible game. It's called MLD, Most Like Dad. Mm. And we'll sit around at Thanksgiving or Christmas, and we'll just be talking, and somebody will say something, and there'll be a gesture or a motion or a look or a tone. And one of the brothers says, they'll point at the offender and say, MLD, MLD. And we all know we're like him in various degrees, and it kills us. My one poor brother, Jim Conroy, who we call the Dark One, always wins.
Really?
Hands down. And he knows it. It drives him crazy. But he knows that he is most like Dad, and Dad's spirit lives most strongly in Jim more than all of us. Thank the Lord. Mm.
But as you said, there were times in your life where you felt like you were, you know, a slightly softer version of your father.
But truth is, deep down, Marty, I am the same guy. I was raised in a household where I saw a mother abuse that almost always ends up, that kid almost always ends up an abuser. I was raised up as a kid where all the kids were beaten. I saw every single one of them beaten at different times. That kid grows up with that image impressed on his consciousness. It does not die. It lives forever. It's a constant struggle, a constant battle for me every day of my life not to be like him. If I ever hit a wife, I'm going to kill myself. I don't want to hit my kids. I just don't want to be that guy. Yet I can feel Dad living in my bloodstream, coming out in my anger, my fury. And sometimes I put that anger in my books.
You said when you wrote The Great Santini that you came across, or I guess after that book was published, you came across this word dysfunctional, that you were a dysfunctional family. But I was thinking about the word. It's so graphic. It doesn't really explain anything about a family.
It doesn't to me. You know, dysfunctional sounds kind of sweet.
It doesn't like, work, right?
You know, plumbing is off, you know. And, you know, what I was seeing, you know, when you see your mother bleed from someone hitting, when your mother ends up stabbing your father during a family argument, you see blood, your dad going up dripping blood and her getting the children out of the house and going racing off and just being beaten up so many times yourself that I think I remember them all, but I don't. You know, sometimes I'll wake up just in the middle of the night. Do you remember another one? I said, I'd forgotten that. Yeah. And I think it affects every aspect of your life coming from a family. And it can be the mother. It doesn't have to be the dad. It can be anybody in that family. And sexual abuse puts another whole new dimension to it. That thank the Lord that did not happen to me. But it is all one thing. Dysfunctional, doesn't quite do it, is a word for me.
Is there a better word?
Not that I can think of. I want to say supersonic. I want to say, a nuclear disaster. But I know growing up in a family like that, there's this inferno kind of feeling that you cannot escape. You cannot get out. You cannot do anything.
You're right. I don't believe in happy families. A family is too frail a vessel to contain the risks of all the warring impulses expressed when such a group meets on common ground. I underlined that.
Yeah, it's. I have a lot of people fight me about, you know, the families. I had a story. I've always loved people that came up to me in signings and they'll say, boy, your family's nuts, aren't they? And I'll say, yeah, they are. And I said, how about your family, pal? And this was one particularly good-looking couple. And the guy said, and he looked like he's going to be governor of South Carolina someday. He's one of those guys.
I think I know what you're talking about. But yeah, go ahead.
And he said, I said, let's be honest. Let's go through your family. How far do we have to go to hit the first crazy? dad, mom, brother, sister, and uncle. And I don't know anything about you, Marty, but, you know, generally that kind of covers it. You know, I can, with that group, I can hit something. I can hit a mother load with that group. This guy says, my family's perfect. They're just, and I said, no, finally his wife can't stand it, and she finally breaks, and she says, his mother's nuts. His mother's nuts. She's crazy. And I said, this is, to me, normality. In a family, a good family is one that, you know, can embrace that, can embrace craziness, can, you know, move that in, soften it when it comes up, deal with it. And we all have to deal with it.
Right.
It's just part of, and it's one of those outer moons of love that none of us quite know what to deal with, but we have to learn to deal with it in some way.
But it seems, and I'm not an expert on families, but it seems, as you describe your father, he's a very extreme example of that. I mean, to think that you're perfect and everything you do and say is absolutely right and everyone has to do exactly what you have to say. I mean, I think a lot of families have perhaps versions of that,
mm-hmm.
but that's scary to me to have a dad like that or a parent like that.
You know, it's so funny. I think the story left me behind years ago. I wrote about it when I was a young man. I'm writing about it now that I'm an old man. And the story still has great powers to mm-hmm. astonish me, to control me. I was in Memphis. No, it was Louisville, Kentucky, and the night before in Nashville with Ann Patchett. And after these things are over, people come up to me. And I had five guys come up to me, one I'm crying, saying, my father was a great Santini. These are young men. I said, I'm so sorry.
Mm.
I had five women come up to me, maybe six or seven women. My mother was a great Santini. And so it's not like these things disappear. And, we can have all the shows, talk shows, Dr. Phil's, Oprah's we want. But something is alive when human beings gather together in a clan and call themselves a family. And it could be the most wonderful, the most explosive word in the world.
Again, we're almost up on a break, but it's interesting that people have appropriated the great Santini. I mean, that's something, when someone says that, my dad was the great Santini, we know what that means.
It's unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And if you're just joining us, Pat Conroy is our guest today on the show. He's the author of 11 books, including The Great Santini. We have been talking quite a bit about that. His new book is a memoir called The Death of Santini and is subtitled The Story of a Father and His Son. And we've been talking about his complicated and conflicted relationship with his father. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Karen Treatment Centers, a proud supporter of WHYY, has seen a dramatic rise in the number of teens abusing prescription drugs such as ADHD medication. Karen offers gender-separate programs for teens focused on building productive, healthy futures through individualized family and group counseling. Details about the signs of teen addiction and Karen's Recovery for Life mission at caron.org/teen or 1-877-369-0121.
Look too far to show the way.
On the next Fresh Air, the golden age of industrial musicals, when Broadway-style musicals were written for corporate sales conventions. We talk with Steve Young, the author of a new book about them, Sheldon Harnick, who wrote songs for them before writing Broadway hits like Fiddler on the Roof, and John Russell, who sang in dozens of industrials. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Has Virginia seceded again? From the South Two Northerners running for gov in Virginia, the new urbanism capital of the Old South. That and everything else for your election day next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And again, Pat Conroy is our guest, author of a new book, a memoir called The Death of Santini, The Story of a Father and His Son. And we have some callers at 1-888-477-9499. We got a tweet from Angela. You were telling me you don't do Twitter, but we do Twitter. We got a tweet from Angela. She's saying watching the movie was what made her realize as a kid that her family wasn't the only one that was like, I guess, your family. And I'm assuming from that movie and also from that book, you got a lot of response, like Angela's, of people saying, I'm not alone.
You know, one thing Angela might be is I discovered a million-footed tribe in our country that's not recognized. It is the military brat. It is those of us who are raised on federal property. We belong nowhere. We belong to nobody. A woman named Mary Wirch wrote a book about military brats that changed my whole life because I knew that I had this confederation or tribe of people out there, and we can't recognize each other. You could be one, and I would not know it. And I can walk down the street and pass 10 of them and would not know it. But I heard from thousands of military brats after this because what they recognized was the spirit of the Corps or the spirit of the Navy or the Air Force or the Army and how that comes into a family, and that is our natural milieu. And that I just got that over and over again.
Did your father, he was a Marine pilot. I mean, did he treat his military colleagues like he treated his family?
Yeah, I thought he was a lousy officer. And the reason I knew this, I played basketball. And I'd go out to the bases, and you know, there'd be guys, enlisted men from his squadron, and they'd find out I was the major's son, and you know, they'd rough me up. You know, all I'd do is wait for this to pass and not tell Dad.
Mm. But they beat you up, you mean?
Well, they would, you know, just not beat me up, but on basketball, they'd knock me around. But I wouldn't tell Dad, would not think about it, and they eventually would accept me, but I heard him talk about Dad. Mm. And I heard him yell at his men. And, you know, when I went to the Citadel, I'd already developed my own ways of leadership. And I always, you know, I developed a way, if I was an officer, I would treat my men, and it was totally opposite of Dad.
Something you said about the Citadel, then I do want to get to our callers, and you did go there. You said, I believe the Citadel plebe system prepared me quite well for the setbacks and disappointments of life. It even prepared me for the savagery and jealousies of my brothers and sisters writers. Sister writers.
Right. Writers are the meanest people on earth.
You think so?
Yeah. I've observed them for a long time now, and they don't mean to be. They can't help it. We were all like this, including me. But, you know, the Citadel and the plebe system was so terrible. I told Mom it was worse than Dad. But I now say, would I rather get a bad review from the New York Times or report to my first sergeant's room after mess? It's always the same thing. Please give me that bad review. Because the one thing that Citadel plebe system did for me is it prepared me for all the bad things that life could throw at you, which have been considerable. I've been surprised how tough life is.
Well, I mean, as you write about it, you've had a number of what appear like breakdowns, including one after the Great Santini. Uh-huh. Sounds like you had a drinking problem for a while. A
huge drinking problem.
Three marriages.
And breakdowns almost after every book I finish.
Really?
You know, just almost everyone, there'd be a breakdown afterwards. And so it was not a great incentive to send me to the writing desk again. But, you know, that happened, and that's the way life goes. And you'd like it to happen differently, but then you look up and you're 68 years old.
Yeah, and you've written 11 books.
Yeah, just, you know, there it is.
Let me see what Olga from Conshohocken has to say. Olga, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. My question is, I mean, there must have been visible bruises or cuts. Did the teachers never investigate? And do you consider it a failure of the social support system you had that you were never taken away from this wild home into foster care or some kind of counseling?
Okay, Olga, you must be a young woman.
30.
Okay.
It's a fair question, though, Olga. Yes, go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, and it's a great question. Here's what it was like in my days. Anytime there were bruises, there were Band-Aids, there were on my face for much of my high school career. Dad had me playing football, basketball, and baseball. I caught an elbow in basketball practice. A guy, you know, my bat flew up, hit my face, gave me a black eye during the game against North Charleston. I always had an excuse. And later on, all these teachers have told me they were sorry that they did not notice more. But, Olga, at that time, I can promise you this, under torture, I would not have admitted that my father had hit any of us, because my mother had us so conditioned to say, if he is drummed out of the Corps, we have no way of living. And she would say, Pat, you and none of your brothers and sisters will go to college. You'll start working as soon as high school's over. So there was a great, you know, this family secret. There was great reasons why we could not go to any authorities. And Dad hurt me one time so badly they had to take me to the hospital. But Mom made up a story about a touch football game we had in the backyard where I hit a water spigot. And it cut my eye, and Dad had thrown a glass at me. The glass broke, and it cut my eye, you know, along the eyebrow. And that was the closest he ever came, I think, to getting caught. But my mother's story won the game, that spirited touch football game.
I'm going to ask this question, but you don't need to answer it. But do you have any resentment towards your mother? Because, in a sense, the family had to defend the father to the outside world.
Well, it's funny. Mom went through, you know, all these. I got the best of Mom. I got the best of Mom. She was, you know, wonderful, lovely, sweet, perfect to me. And the younger brother and sister have a darker portrait of Mom. And, you know, they wonder why she didn't do something to, you know, protect us more. I'm going, what could she do? But, see, I've become, you know, her enabler. And I don't know what she could do. And I know that she had a massive hysterectomy in 1963, military hospital, which I always thought was the lowest medicine on earth. And she was never the same woman afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know what hormones, you know, we never talked about it. The family didn't talk about it. I know she almost died. She was in the hospital for over a month. And she was different after that. You know, but I didn't care.
She was your mom.
She was my mom, and I loved her, and I adored her. But some of the kids do think she had a lot of responsibility for this.
And that's Pat Conroy, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of The Death of Santini, The Story of a Father and His Son. It's his new memoir. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Lynn from Newark, Delaware, to join us. Lynn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I am. It's really wonderful to hear you speak about your own life, but you write such beautiful prose, almost lyrical, about the most horrid familial interactions, and then somehow love comes out the other end. And I just, your language is always, written language has just always captivated me. But how do you take yourself that way? How do you describe these real horrors in beautiful language?
It's a great question, Lynn. Go ahead, Pat Conroy.
What was the question exactly?
The question is that, and what she notices, and I agree with you, Lynn, which is that in your writing, you can write about the most horrific kind of things in the most lyrical kind of language. So her question is really, how do you find the beautiful words to describe such horror? And perhaps that's what writers do.
I don't know. And it is my sister Carol, who's a terrific poet. When she writes her poetry, I always say, Carol, no one bleeds in your poetry. You know, no one. And I know you and I bled. And I don't understand using a language, and she uses it so beautifully, I cannot tell you. And she has a much greater lyrical gift than I have. But we both have one. But what I am obsessed with is telling the truth. And I'd rather tell it in a way that brings readers along and does not repulse them, because the stories I'm telling is fairly repulsive. And it's hard to read about a kid getting beat up. It's very hard to read about a woman getting beat up by a 220-pound Marine. And, you know, that has been my subject matter much of my life. And so I try to use this lyricism to at least make it sound different, to come at it in a different way. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Lynn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Adrian from Valley Forge has to say. Adrian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is for Pat, and how, knowing that your father was so abusive throughout your entire life and virtually ruined your childhood, as it sounds like.
No, he ruined my childhood. That's correct.
Yeah.
How are you able, and why did you choose to continue having a relationship with him and essentially memorializing him through your novel, The Great Santini?
Well, I think it was that I realized that my father hated my portrait of him in The Great Santini with his body and soul. I think Dad was so stupid that in the way he grew up, his job was this: provide a house, money, provisions, schooling, and, you know, a safe place for kids to grow up. Okay, for Dad, that was
safe.
It.
Yeah, safe.
Yeah,
right.
Safe. And I think he thought it was safe. You know, we never got robbed. We never got anything like that. And in Dad's way, you know, he grew up in a Chicago, rough area of Chicago. You know, he thought he was the perfect father, which seems utterly ridiculous. When he saw his son present his other portrait, Dad spent a whole life trying to make me a liar for this fictional character that I had made up out of color. And he would sign his books, "My son certainly has a vivid imagination, doesn't he? And I hope you enjoy my son's work of fiction." He underlined fiction 10 times. But what I appreciated about Dad, and it did not come overnight, was there was a slow accumulation of him coming back, and I told him everything I thought about him. I held nothing back. And I screamed at him. I yelled at him. He took it all. When my brother Tom, my youngest brother, committed suicide, my father could not speak for 3 days because he was weeping. And it was at that time the kids in the family said, okay, Dad can't tell us he loves us. It's beyond him, but he can show he loves Tom. And we none of us knew that. And so we said, let's try to forget what happened and see what kind of a life we can have until Dad dies. And the family did pretty well. We did the best we could.
Did you forgive your father? Was that important to do that?
I think it was in, you know, and for me is, you know, my worry about being Dad. By forgiving Dad, I'm not Dad.
Oh, yes.
I'm not him.
Yes.
And by saying, okay, Dad, that's what you had to do for whatever reason, that's you. It's not me. And I'm older now. I've seen a lot of life now. I understand it better now. I still think you are the biggest jerk that ever lived. And I told him that on his deathbed. And, you know, you shouldn't have done that. But I got it told to you. And it'll be all right. It'll be okay.
You write it actually when right after you wrote The Great Santini, as you said, after all your books, you have a bit of a nervous breakdown. But you write, "It never occurred to me that I was born with a need to love my dad. It seemed like a madman's fantasy that my father could ever bring himself to love me." But you, in writing that, you realized that, yes, you hated him, but you needed to love him as
well. I needed the guy to love me. I needed a father. And I can't explain that. It, in the world I grew up in, the world of Santini, the world of the Citadel, you know, that is showing extraordinary weakness. Too bad.
Yeah.
I needed the guy to love me. And, you know, eventually I think I forced him to. I think he's the first father in I can think of in history that was forced to love his son because of literature, because of books, because of art. And dad could not help it. He got swept along with the process.
Well, and, it's, and we're almost out of time here, but it sounds like there, in many parts in your adult life, you would have coffee together. I mean, he was over at your house or apartment.
Every day. Right. He was over there, and I would tell him every day that he stunk as a father. He just kept coming back. And he, you know, he came back, and he came back, and he kept coming back. And he did it to all seven of his kids, every one of us. And the great Santini, none of us ever thought the word great would apply to him in any way at all. But there was something about his redemption that shocked us.
Well, on that note, Pat Conroy, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, it's been great.
Great for us as well. And again, the book, the memoir called The Death of Santini, The Story of a Father and His Son. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to learn more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.